Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Ann Parfit, and she will be speaking on business ethics, an oxymoron. So let's listen in on Ann.
We're here to discuss business ethics and whether or not that really is an oxymoron. Today, at the conclusion of this session, I hope we will have achieved a couple of things. First, some clarity about the kinds of issues that give us cold pricklies when we think about business, and also a little bit of understanding about the dilemmas that are faced by businesses today. This is going to be an interactive session because I'm going to ask you to vote on a number of case studies that I'm going to present. In other words, I'm going to give you a case study that actually happened in a corporation, give you the options that the corporation had, and then ask you just to vote. We're not going to count them up or anything like that, but just so that you can feel some ownership in what's going on here. Also, because this summer we are working with our theme of a foretaste of the feast to come, I will tell you that I did consider that, and that this session is based on Matthew 5:19 out of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. And that's really important with regard to business ethics. Our emotions do get involved. From the Child's book, Faith, Formation, and Decision, I want to give you a couple of thoughts from Jim Child so that we can ground ourselves a little bit in the Christian ethic. Dr. Child says, the disposition of the peacemaker is one of commitment to actively work toward reconciliation and wholeness where there is conflict and estrangement. It involves readiness to engage in conflict when it is necessary to reconcile. It involves struggle to reorder and renew relationships when they are broken and marked by hostility. It involves respect for the neighbor that precludes behavior that contributes to alienation. And later in the book, that's from page 61, and then on page 67, he says, peace does not come cheaply when parties are in conflict and wrongs have been done. The process of reconciliation is not only of papering over the hurts and the wrongs with a too easy forgiveness. Neither is it a matter of overlooking those wrongs and allowing them to go unchallenged. Rather, reconciliation requires acknowledging wrongs, repentance, and a commitment to change. Now, change isn't easy for any of us. And I want to kind of demonstrate that, or at least the implication of that, by asking you to look at me, okay? Cross your arms in front of yourselves, okay? Don't look down. Now cross your arms back. How comfortable does that feel? If we can be a little bit uncomfortable just uncrossing our arms and crossing our arms, whether we look or not, just so you can feel how it feels, we can maybe understand a little bit of the implications of trying to change our minds and the resistance we have when we're trying to imagine the discomfort of a corporation that's trying to go through some very difficult decisions. Some of those decisions are forced on them, and some of them they take on their own accord. So, with regard to business ethics, I'm going to ask you to vote on some cases, and these come from General Electric Corporation. Okay, let's go. The first one, this mini dilemma. Kidder Peabody is a company owned by General Electric. Now, GE purchased a small company, or Kidder Peabody purchased a small company that they were going to absorb into their existing corporation without changing the name. And they did due diligence, and that due diligence revealed no problems with the small company, so they bought it up. But once they owned the small company, there was a problem hiding inside. A former employee admitted taking bribes for insider trading. Three subordinates must have known there was proof. So it wasn't just one person, but three persons under that director. The problem was that there was going to be public disclosure of this. So the question is Kidder Peabody, the new owner, guilty? Now, if Kidder Peabody pleads guilty, this is a felony charge, and they could be put out of business. That's a decision of the court, not a decision they'll make. or they could choose to cooperate and request the court's full consideration. So, should they plead innocent and fight the charges we're not guilty? How many raise your hands? Should they say we're guilty and request the court's full consideration?
Let's try that again.
There's gotta be another
choice.
That's what they thought. That's it. That's the only choice they have. They can either plead innocent and fight it, or they can say we're guilty. They're our people, our subsidiary, or we own them now, not even a subsidiary, actually. Our employees.
We go again?
Yeah, okay. Do they plead innocent and fight? Or do they plead guilty and ask the court for full consideration of the situation? Phil, I see you doing this.
What's the charge? The actual charge?
The charge is a felony for insider trading.
Against?
Against Kidder Peabody.
I don't quite understand the setup. There's a small company that Kidder Peabody bought.
Yes.
And they didn't know that there had been some mucking around going on.
Right, in the small company that they bought. Now they own it. It's part of them.
Well, then, I guess I would vote. Hey, we're innocent. We did our due diligence and we didn't know what was going on.
Okay, so we have some innocents, we have some guilties. Okay, I'll tell you what happened. They did plead guilty and requested the court's full consideration. Now, along with that, there's another question. What about the subordinates? What about the person who did the deed and the subordinates? Should they support those people or should they abandon them? If they support them, they're keeping them in-house. If they abandon them, they can keep them in-house or let them go. Okay, so should they...
loaded language to say abandon them.
Yeah.
It would seem just to require that anyone works in your corporation be honest, and if someone did something honest, they gotta fess up, they gotta pay the consequences.
Okay. So, should they support them or should they not support them? How about that? Should they support them?
I think they should support them in giving them, encouraging them to confess that they were wrong.
Okay. Okay.
Why is that funny?
Well, because it's not an option, because you're changing the rules on me. You're changing the rules because that wasn't an option they were given.
But it ought to be.
Ethical thinking means trying to come up with the right solution, not just buying.
That's true, but the court and the law don't always allow you that flexibility. And so that's the situation.
I would think if they plead innocent in the one case, then they have to be seen to
support.
If I have the case all wrong.
Oh, okay. They have to seem to abandon. Okay.
If they plead innocent in the first case, and we didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. Once they find out, they have to be seen to purge themselves of the problem.
See.
So I would think it would follow that having pled innocent, they would have to abandon the people who didn't divulge this insider stuff and should have ethically.
Yeah,
in reality,
didn't they plead guilty?
Yeah.
They did plead guilty.
They did plead guilty,
and they asked for the court's discretion. Full consideration are the legal terms they use. What they did was they chose to remove those people from their positions and pay their salaries until the court decision was final, because there was that dual case. And then they said, we will pay your attorney fees only if you are found innocent. So... it was a tough case for General Electric Kidder Peabody. Now, let's throw that one away and try another one. Okay, General Electric is building a power plant in India. It's an international decision. That's a different culture. And in that culture, there's an expectation that if you are being given a contract, you'll make a contribution to the reigning political party. But that's illegal by U.S. standards. So the question is, does General Electric pay or does General Electric lose the contract? Okay? How many say pay?
You mean mean what we think they should have done or what they did?
Ethically, what should, you are General Electric, what will you do? Will you pay? Will you pay? Will you lose the contract? Okay, well, they lost the contract. The result of these two cases is this. At least for General Electric, the rule is this. Where there are clear-cut rules or codes or law, we will follow the law. And their reasoning is that it's good for business to have high ethical standards. And they admit that this is easier in the United States than it is in China or in Russia, but it's easier. Behind that, they say that we all grew up together in the same culture, and we went to the same schools, and we have the same ideas of right and wrong. Now, I will tell you that in talking to them, they never talked about good and bad. They talked about right and wrong, but then we're talking about the law here. However, in a world like ours that's in a constant state of movement, there are some gray areas, and there are some conundrums. And those are both not only legal conundrums, but they're social and economic conundrums. And we're going to talk about some social ones next. The next case they faced is one that a lot of corporations seem to have been facing in the last few years, one of sexual harassment. They hired a new employee who had excellent, excellent credentials. And he was 6 weeks on the job, and 11 charges of sexual harassment were filed against him.
In that six weeks.
Reference checks, they went back and said, did we do reference checks? Indeed they had, and those checks had revealed no indication of any preceding problems. So the dilemma then for them was, should they fire this man on the spot, or should they forgive this person and retrain, that is, with a behavioral psychologist, provide some support? So we have two choices for this man. We can either fire him or we can train, okay? We're going to fire him. We're going to train him. Okay, they trained. Okay, now we'll just keep on moving. In the case of child care and General Electric, GE is not only big companies like Kidder Peabody and all of the GE plants we know about, but they also have some small offices all over the country. And in one office, they had only six employees. And among those six employees, three were women who were pregnant at the same time. So what that meant was they were going to face a 50% loss of their workforce at one time. So the local office decided that they would bring the babies to work and set up their own little child care center there. The corporation was concerned because they said, does this set a precedent for the rest of the corporation? Now this is a good 15 years ago, so this wasn't a time when child care was a big thing in corporations. So the dilemma for them, for General Electric Corporate, was whether or not to let this program in this small office continue or to stop it because it would set a precedent. Okay? So, should they stop it or should they let it continue? Should they stop it? Stop the program? Because it'll set a precedent? Or should they let it continue? Okay. They let it continue, but I will tell you the rest of the story. They said it's not a good idea, and since then they've instituted daycare. So, it did set a precedent, whether they wanted it to or not. So I guess there's really no way to back and forth on that one. We've had some variation among the opinions here. Not a lot. Everybody seems to be going in just about the same direction. Business attitudes are generally consistent with social attitudes, with the spirit of ethics in the greater workplace when it comes to things like the law and social issues, where there's a clear-cut code or where it's something that we already are talking about in the world at large. We generally will find some agreement. We don't always find that with the economy. And there are a couple of cases from General Electric with that. With regard to charitable giving, we'll go back a few years. And if you can remember the economic climate when profits were down and there were a lot of layoffs, and there were questions that in the paper all the time about corporations who should do more for the community because there were a lot of layoffs, and there was a big push for matching funds from corporations for organizations like the United Way. And so those matching funds programs really got a big kickoff about, again, 15 or 20 years ago. At about 10 years ago, a United Way official was indicted for misuse of funds, personal use of funds. So a lot of companies cried out and said, no more matching funds. We're stopping this. We can't trust United Way. We can't trust any of them. And GE was in the middle of this fray. And so the question then was, do we cut off matching funds because we're tight anyway? The economy's bad, and clearly this money is not being put to good use if we can believe that all of these organizations are like the United Way. Or do we continue to support the United Way and other organizations like that with our matching funds programs? So the question then is, do we cut off matching funds or do we continue matching funds? Okay? How many say cut off matching funds? How many say continue matching funds? Okay, that's what they did. General Electric continued the matching funds program and went public with this story and said that the companies that were not providing matching funds were using that as an excuse to finally get out from under something they found they didn't want to do because their employees indeed were counting on matching funds and were holding them accountable. This one's a little more difficult. General Electric has a lot of competitors, and they found that the stock prices of one of their competitors was dropping. And they looked at the company, and they said, this company is poorly managed. They're losing money. But we can do something with them. They are ripe for takeover. We'd like to buy them. We'd like to reorganize them. We can make them profitable. Of course, that'll require cutting about 1,000 jobs. Of course, that deal didn't go through. The company objected. We don't want to be bought out by you. We want to run ourselves. I mean, we're poorly managed, but that's what you say. So then the question is, a hostile takeover or drop the pursuit? Because they weren't going to be bought willingly. Okay, does this make sense? Okay, so do we have a hostile takeover or do we have dropping the pursuit? Okay, hostile takeover. Drop the pursuit. Hostile takeover. Hostile takeover. Company would have gone out of business eventually anyway. General Electric's argument is that they at least were able to save some jobs this way.
I think that term hostile just has this is a loaded word.
It is, but it's the language that we use. Mm-hmm. Takeover. Mm-hmm. But it is a hostile takeover when the company fights it. Mm-hmm. You're right, that is. It is.
No one wants to be involved in anything hostile.
It's true.
I mean, if you use that, but that's
I'm so used to the language, you know, of working in business like this that I don't even hear it anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I'm, what's the language that you use? We're gonna talk about it tonight. I'm desensitized to that language.
Well, they call it hostile for a reason, is my guess.
Yes, but in here, as I'm trying to get you to vote one way or the other, I could have been a little bit cleaner and wasn't. So, thank you, Phil.
But of course, I mean, as soon as I get, I don't want to involve anything that's hostile. You know,
that's true.
The way I hear that word, not in the business world, but a forced takeover is really what it is nowadays.
Yeah, that would have been a little easier to think about without getting your bones into it. Yeah, it is. Okay, let's try another one. General Electric has a number of competitors, as we talked about, and one of them moved to Mexico because they could save about 10% of their production costs. GE's factory is in the Midwest, Wisconsin actually, and so they went to the union there and they said, we would like you to take a pay cut to make us competitive again because our competitor is now able to underbid us in the market and we're losing contracts. The union refused, and General Electric began to lose orders and, of course, lose money. So General Electric then had a choice to make between closing the Midwest plant or staying in Wisconsin and taking the losses and keeping those jobs and protecting the community and all that is entailed with that. They realized the impact that closing the plant will have. So do they either close the plant or do they stay in Wisconsin, keep the plant open, and save the jobs of those people? Do you see the difference? Okay, so it's close the plant or leave the plant open even though it's losing money. So close the plant.
Does close the plant imply moving to Mexico?
No, it's just close the plant.
Oh.
Close the plant because it's losing money.
You don't know how much money they're going to lose and whether it's going to be really detrimental to the company or not, or if they're just going to take it as a loss.
A loss is a loss is a loss.
They couldn't keep taking a loss on a plant. Because, I mean, no company can do that.
I don't want to influence you. I've already said hostile takeover. You're not going to get me again. I know what I wrote up here. I'm talking around what I wrote.
the difficulty with these is that sometimes they really are this cut and dry, but often they're not. And it could be that many, many avenues have been explored, but there are so many nuances when you come to this, and that's what the quality movement is all about, and all kinds of movements where people have begun. There are companies that have been successful against rivals in third world countries by using severe quality methods and other sorts of things. Now, I don't know if this has been explored or not, but it seems to me that part of the whole issue of ethics in business is looking for different ways to do this, or if you've got to shut a plant, saying, what are our ethics in how we're going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one thing to say yay or nay, and I know that that they may have had to say yay or nay, but we're kind of in a vacuum.
We are.
And
we always are when we're on the outside looking into a corporation.
So we can't say, just like you can't judge another's behavior. I mean, you could, well, you can't judge the motivations behind another's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
This is a shot in the dark.
Yes, it
you
is.
But I can't say what's the right thing to do.
Well, for the moment, I'm going to ask you to. I'm going to ask you, should they close the plant or should they keep the plant open and take the losses, okay? We'll come back to that, I promise you. Are we going to close the plant? Are we going to keep the plant open and take the losses? Well, you know, they close the plant. You're absolutely right. They close the plant. And all of the things that you're talking about in terms of the options that need to be considered are a part of business ethics. And you're absolutely right. There are lots more things that need to be considered with these decisions and with other decisions as well. These aren't the only ones, but these were the ones that I chose because they were the ones that allow me to say to you in looking at the big picture of cases with numbers of companies that we usually don't have a problem with our business ethics. When we're dealing with law, when we're dealing with social problems, we usually can come pretty close with the corporation, not always, but there's a good bit of ground there where we can cross over and we can have some dialogue. When it comes to money, it doesn't always work out that way.
But
and
the union also have an ethic involved here.
Yes?
I mean, their ethic was involved in what the way they were dealing.
Mm-hmm. And what is that?
Well, I mean, their ethic was involved in their money. I mean, they said they had to have so much money. And
knowing that the company...
Knowing that the company would
shut them down.
Probably shut them down if they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Probably didn't believe them.
So there's a trust issue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't trust. We need to question... from this perspective, what this means for us as a religious community. And what that means is that when religion is individualistic, the common good is lost. And without the common good, business has no fairness rules to follow. So only the law will inhibit business practices in a lot of these situations. So we are a community of promise, And a lot of us, as we are working in the business world, are faced with dilemmas in which we bring what we do on Sunday to work with us on Monday, and it's very difficult for us to know how to apply Sunday to Monday. End up being a Monday morning quarterback sometimes. The realities of this, according to the current president of GE Capital Corporation, are these. We learn as we go. That's what he said. None of us are experts at what we do. We all went to the same schools. He kept saying that. We all went to the same schools. We all learn by the same methods. We all have the same right and wrong rules. And we learn as we go. And the world is constantly changing. The international free market competition is changing our business. Third world companies, he says, are taking our contracts, and that's his language. They have lower expenses. Human rights issues are avoided. I hope you'll speak to this, Glenn. And he also said technological advances are dominant factors with regard to a competitive marketplace. If you get up to speed with technology today, you don't know what's going to come along tomorrow that's going to be even faster, better, more profitable that your competitor will have tomorrow, and you've already got your money invested over here. He also said that business cannot be thoroughly in sync with social goals. He said business goals are economic. That's it. And the bottom line is what influences their decision making. So GE then, I said, well, what are your recommendations for the church? You know, we're interested in giving you recommendations. What are your recommendations for us? He said, first of all, you and the church need to expand your influence of approach. Okay, what does that mean? That sounded pretty fancy. He said you need to package social programs. You need to have videos and pamphlets on what you're doing. He said you need to send these kits throughout the church. Everyone needs to know, because your members do include business persons, and they need to know what you're doing in the community. So, he said, first, expand the influence. Secondly, develop partnerships with business. He said, business doesn't always cut itself off from the church, so take your problems to business. And with regard to social needs in the community, the church, he says, rarely works to obtain visibility for its efforts. And he said, so when you do something, go out there, do that, get some visibility, and take credit for what you're doing. So expand the influence of your approach, let your members know what you're doing and bring them into the program. And secondly, develop partnerships. Take problems to business and let everybody know about it. I'm not saying these are good. These are his ideas, not my ideas. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, set up a hotline. Listen to business persons who are facing ethical dilemmas. There are people out there who are facing these dilemmas, don't know where to go, don't know where they can get answers. So set up a hotline. Wouldn't you just love it if all the people start calling your church and saying, this is my problem?
I'm going to have to close my company and lay off thousands of workers. What do you think I should do?
Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's just what every pastor is looking for. And fourthly, and I think this of all the things he suggested, this one makes sense. Be patient. Recognize that we're all struggling, and help us to find ways to deal with these problems, even if you don't like the other suggestions. That one worked for me. Now, that didn't mean just stand by and kind of watch and kick the dirt and get mad and stomp when something goes bad, but work together in some kind of dialogue. Does anybody want to add something to this? I did pull out a couple things. I pulled out, what does this mean to a pastor and to you, Glenn? And working with the kinds of things you work with in two-thirds third world countries. So would you like to add to this at this point?
I'd be curious in that Wisconsin situation, if the churches in that community would have invited people from both sides, and then the disinterested third party to say, listen, we've got a problem here. Let's get the union and get our management together, and we, the church, because this is going to impact our community, we just want to get you two together.
So how would you think that would happen? Would the pastor do it? Would the who would initiate it? How?
I don't know why the church is together. I think it would have to be done probably a joint effort of the churches in that particular community. I don't know how big a community it was. Mm-hmm.
La Crosse, Wisconsin.
In Germany has these academies where the church itself brings together disputing groups and simply form a neutral ground where they can at least talk in a setting that is both non-threatening and grace-centered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Glenn.
Well, I guess if I had to pick an issue that is both really, really big and has a really major impact and raises these kinds of questions, I would pick the global arms trade. All through the 80s, there was an issue of, can a Christian work in a defense plant? And the problem was that there were varying points of view about U.S. vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, and, there was at least an argument that could be made that, we needed to restrain or contain this, this threat. They had weapons too, they threatened us with them. The irony is that on the arms trade, all through the Cold War, we would ask, why are we selling arms to the Shah of Iran, our major customer in the 70s, mm-hmm. or to Marcos, Noriega, Zaire, Indonesia, all these despots. And we were told, well, they're not great, but, their regional rival is getting arms from the Soviet Union. And we didn't totally believe it, but that was the rationale we got. I mean, there are despots, but there are despots. The end of the Cold War comes. Now, the United States and the Soviet Union were both playing the game. We had carved up the world. We were selling arms to different sides, arming each side of the teeth. And each of the countries were selling in the $12 to $15 billion a year range. Now I'll use constant dollars so we can really compare from the 80s up through the 90s. Lo and behold, the end of the Cold War comes. Not only did we not reduce the sale of arms, particularly to the Third World, but we've increased it both in dollar amount. Each of the 4 years since the end of the Cold War, we've sold two or three times the value of the arms. But whereas the arms that were sold let's define something, to authoritarian regimes, that is not democracies, bad on human rights, used to be under 50%, it's now 85-90% of all the arms we're selling are going to despots of one stripe or another. To countries that, we may have been sold our idea that they're good, like Saudi Arabia, but there's very little democracy. Their court system is virtually non-existent. Rights of women and minorities are non-existent or near. And nobody, can really assure us that these countries are going to be even ruled by the group in power now, just like Iran. I mean, who believes that Khomeini was an improvement? And I think an interesting question would be, is it appropriate for Christians in those countries, in those companies that make those weapons, to ask what's going on, and ultimately to work on those companies? And what is the church saying about both the, the political, geopolitical situation on the larger sphere, but also on the grassroots level, within congregations that have these big defense contractors and subcontractors, what are we doing? What kind of questions are we raising? We could change the words of the song, we arm the world.
Yeah. You've raised this whole situation you've brought up, this is an economic problem. The reason this is, isn't that right? You've described the economic problems as being intractable, that in social issues and
Legal issues.
We tend to be kind of congruent here. When we get into economic issues, we end up doing things that we look at and say, don't know if I want to do that.
But as an individual in a corporation, can you do anything?
Not a damn thing. There's really not. You'll get killed or lose your job or something. I've known too many people to whom it's happened to me.
So do we need to consider ourselves individuals in these situations, or are we part of a community?
Well, we can only be part of a community in this because it's clearly a community problem. It seems to me there's two things going on. One is we don't seem to have a community ethic going on, a workable community ethic around economic issues. They're getting away from us in some ways. And the other is, and I kept running across this in my brain with the situations that we were posing, we had a lack of ability to think newly and creatively with the situation that was given, not just in ethics, but in a business sense. You could have solved your problem in a business sense, and some companies are reaching out and beginning to solve that very problem in a business sense, both keeping the business running and keeping people employed on purely business principles, where we're going to find new ways to do just in time or quality or whatever, and we're going to keep this plant open even though our rivals are in Mexico. So both better business practices and as a church standing up, because an individual can only commit suicide on that kind of a problem.
With whistleblowing, you mean?
With whistleblowing.
It depends what the pressures are on that individual, I think. I mean, quite honestly, if this is a person who has a family to take care of and has a history with the company, whistleblowing decisions are going to be much more difficult than for someone who's in the first job and, you know, fresh out of school. But then it's hard for the younger person who's not been in the corporate world to be able to evaluate what's going on. And do I really? They can't possibly. I mean, what do I do? And all of those kinds of shuffle, which way do we go? And you got to play the game. And I just spent 4 years of my life, and I'm still paying off my college debts. And, you know, so the dilemmas are different for everybody. And if we're standing alone with them, with those, if we're standing by ourselves, it's pretty difficult to operate in that situation. But I would at the same time remind myself in thinking this through that God doesn't work only through the church. God also works through business and through all these other entities. So we don't know what's at play sometimes. We don't know everything.
I guess, in the same way that I was trying to, you know, broaden or not accept the given alternatives, I think there's some hope there. I mean, you know, it's not, there may be some other options besides whistleblowing, like, you know, slowly and patiently building up political consciousness among your coworkers and among, you know, people in the next unit down, but not by, you know, sort of reading the riot act or telling them, you know, this is horrible, but saying, you know, how do you feel about, you know, where these are going, and bringing in clippings and leaving them on the bulletin board and so forth. But doing it in a way that tries to create a safe place where people can wrestle with the issue themselves. I mean, because the reality is, if you blow your wad and get thrown out, you haven't solved anything. You haven't helped yourself, but you also haven't helped the problem. I mean, so it doesn't seem to be a fruitful option to simply commit suicide.
No, it's not, and that is.
To say, you know, and when people say, you know, what are you raising these questions for? Look, to respond, I work here. This is my company. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I want to continue to work here. But, you know, is the bottom line the only question? In other words, start throwing it back on people to say, to get them to engage the issue and not you.
That requires a place where there's trust and where truthfulness can be handled in a way that allows those kinds of discussions to happen. We talked about this when we got together and we were talking about Oklahoma City a couple days ago, And the bottom line with that one is, if you have an environment where you can discuss these issues with understanding and openness, then that can happen. And hopefully, if that's not there, that you can find ways to create it within certain communities within the corporation. And that certainly does everyone a lot of good.
It does seem, too, that there's a real place for the church in that, because as an insider doing that, you're terribly vulnerable. You're the one who's saying, wait a minute, there's a dead elephant in the room.
Right.
And however you do that, gently or with, you know, pointedly, the chances are very great of people around you being in denial and simply saying, well, old Joe over there, he's always been a little off.
Or talking to the higher-ups and give me fire.
Whatever.
We've always done it this way, all kinds of things. Yeah, all kinds of excuses.
Or just, you know, buying the line. I mean, there's always at least a patina of some kind of national security reason. I mean, this is our ally, we want to support it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, one of the ironies is that we sold to like 50 or 60 or 70 countries during the Cold War, and each of the last couple of years, we've sold to more than 140 countries in the world. I mean, the majority of the countries of the world are recipients of U.S. arms sales and aid, or both, including, you know, even some so-called communist countries. So it's, I mean, it's the denial and the lies that just are even so superficial. I mean, they're transparent, almost like a children's story that I've heard recently. I mean, I've seen the defense that has to pass through the political process for selling like a major modern weapon system. That I should just insert. Another problem with it is that we're not just selling our old stuff like in the old days. We're selling the most high-tech weapons around. The main battle tank that won the Gulf War is not only being sold all over the world, but it's actually being built in a number of countries. The F-16 fighter, one of the two top fighters in the world, is being built in 16 countries. I mean, we're selling the technology, we're selling the store, and if you are interested, we could get into it. The economics are not what you think. The country is not making much on these. We're subsidizing so many of these arms deals. In a whole lot of ways, we're a good argument could be made and has been made in both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times business section that we're not really gaining much economically. We'd be better if we're going to subsidize something. Why not subsidize something that really sells? Where you're not talking about 10 and 20 and 50 billion, but you know, hundreds of billion, trillion.
Now, consequences that some of these companies are likely to go out of business is that. Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, that's true in any other field, too. I mean, there's lots of, you know, I mean, what happened to all of those poor people that made, you know, harnesses and carriages?
In automobiles.
Well, they moved into something else. Yeah.
So it's not enough to do what's right anymore. You have to go further.
Okay, but to do that, now, it seems that that's a paradigm for almost any problem you run up against, that it's wrong. I mean, who can argue, at least in this room? I suppose somebody could, but I wouldn't. Okay, so this is wrong, and we shouldn't be doing that. And to stop doing it, some companies are probably going to go down, and people are going to lose their jobs, and all those sorts of things. We're back to the plant closing thing. Right or wrong, we still have to deal with that and don't really have any social mechanism.
See, part of the reason is that the business community, I mean, about a decade ago, there was a big debate about industrial policy.
Yes.
And the business community almost universally, I mean 90%+, decided they didn't want the United States to do what most of the rest of the developed world does, which is have a mechanism, a vehicle to discuss like the future of the economy. They wanted it to be laissez-faire, and it was because they saw, I think accurately, that if the government was involved in that in some fashion, they would end up, you know, directing and having their hands in some other areas. And the business community decided they would rather not have that. So the result is that, it's functional in some ways for the business community, because when you don't have any, you know, mechanisms to deal with displaced workers, whether it's timber or defense contracts or whatever, the pressure is on communities and on individuals and on political figures to play ball, you know, to behave as though the economic issue was the absolute paramount overriding, you know, veto everything else on the table kind of issue. Where, even poor countries, Yugoslavia, if a company closed, they had a fund that had been contributed to over the years that would place, you know, that would help find jobs for everybody in the company.
We have those kinds of services here. What's we have it? Outsourcing here.
Sometimes.
Not to the point where people, where, you know, workers in factories feel like it's any kind of safety net.
Do they feel like it's a safety net
in
Yugoslavia?
I don't think very many people do feel like they're going to get much help if their company closes.
Okay, so there's an opportunity for us as a community to look at those kinds of things, I think. Maybe not in terms of the whole United States, but in terms of our own communities and the corporations in the cities and neighborhoods where we live. I know of one in Cleveland that absolutely does have really good outsourcing. And I don't know many that are that good. But they even have a place called the Silver Bullet Lounge. And if you are fired from that company, regardless, if you are fired, and I know one of my bosses was fired because she did something really stupid. And I mean, this was like publicly in a magazine about the president of the company, stupid, could be proven stupid. And she had a drinking problem. So she was fired, but she was fired in 30 days. So you're out of your office and you go up to the Silver Bullet Lounge and you're still employed for the outside world, and you can use every resource we have here, and we'll help you with your resume, and we're bringing in consultants, and you will get another job. 30 days we're giving you. And this is for a woman who did something bad to the president of the company, and it went all the way down. So that can be initiated, but that, I think, is extremely rare. Extremely rare.
Is it the job of the community of churches in this terribly, terribly difficult thing to at least start raising the question? Solutions aren't necessarily easy, and I've gotten caught up in protest politics myself. Oh, bad, 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 you shouldn't be doing that, nasty, nasty. And it's real easy to take your sign and beat them over the head. And it doesn't necessarily help invite everybody to solve the problem.
But if we're out there at the same time and watching companies and going, good, 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 when
yes.
they do something
yes.
right, and
yes.
creating a relationship with those organizations,
right.
then when the time comes that we don't like what's happening, mm-hmm. we've got an opportunity because we have been in dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do it inside our own community with business people and getting involved, and you know, it doesn't take too much time, 20 minutes, to send off a letter when, gee whiz, I read in the paper or I heard from someone in my church that you're doing thus and such, and I just want to tell you in two sentences, wow. And it's a little thing, but those are the kinds of tools that we can use. And even though I don't really agree with all of the things that the gentleman from GE said in terms of this is what you ought to do in terms of visibility, I think that there are some elements in there of building that we can look at and find where we can build relationships. We've got just a couple more minutes, and I want to end on a light note because some of this stuff is really heavy, and we're going to dinner, and I don't want anybody's digestion to be thwarted. So I'm going to tell you a story about Purdue, and it's a business ethics story, and it involves the church.
Frank,
actually,
University.
Hmm?
Frank. University.
Frank Purdue. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, Frank Purdue. Frank Purdue, of course, wants to sell chickens, and he's very good at that, and he's very, very good in marketing. And while he's not Catholic, he has someone in his corporation who is Catholic, who's very close to him, and who's very active in the Catholic Church. And he said, could you get me a meeting with the Pope? I know you're going to Italy, but I'd kind of like to talk to the Pope. And, you know, I mean, you'd be surprised what you can get done. A meeting was set up with the Pope. It can happen. I mean, as in PR, I've done these kinds of things with president of the country before, so I know that they can be set up. So meeting was set up with the Pope, and he did have a good reason. He said, I want to donate some money to the Catholic Church. I think that you're doing some good things. We have a lot of people in our company who are Catholic, and we want to support the Church. So I'm thinking about giving you $5 million. And the Pope said, I'm overwhelmed. I don't know what to say. What can we do? What can we do for you? How can we thank you? And Frank said, well, you know, interesting that you should ask. Here's just one little thing I would like. There's this one prayer. I'd like you to just change one word in it. And it's, you know that part where it goes, give us this day our daily chicken. That's what I'd like you to have. Give us this day our daily chicken. The Pope said, I don't know if we can do that. That's pretty hard. I mean, that's one of our oldest prayers. Did I say poem? Prayers.
Prayers, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of our oldest prayers, and it's part of our tradition. I don't think I can change this. $7.5 million. I don't know. I mean, the people are used to this. We've been using this prayer forever. $10 million. I'll have to take it up with the cardinals. Meeting of the cardinals happened the very next day, and the Pope gathered them around and he said, listen, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is we're being offered $10 million by a gentleman in the United States. The bad news is we have to cancel our long-term contract with Wonder Bread. I hope you've enjoyed this session. Thank you very much.